Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I am the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart, and the owner of a new shock mount. I'm actually trying out the shock mount today. We'll see how it works. In this interview, we're going to find out how an entrepreneur with a habit of not finishing things, how that entrepreneur actually ended up writing and finishing a book. And more importantly, for the focus of our work here at Mixergy, how did he turn that book into a real business that produces hundreds of thousands of dollars? Nathan Barry is that entrepreneur. He is the designer and entrepreneur whose latest company is ConvertKit, which offers software that allows you to create landing pages that capture leads and it sends out automated emails. He is also the author of Designing Web Applications, Authority, and the App Design Handbook. And why don't we just jump right into the interview, Nathan? Good to see you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Nathan, as a developer, do you ever feel like a fraud as a designer? Do you ever feel like a fraud and say to yourself, hey, if I was so good at this stuff, I'd be creating my own software. If I'm not, then I'm selling books and becoming a marketer.
Yeah, so first of all, I definitely feel like a fraud on other fronts, maybe not on this, but okay. Imposter syndrome is definitely present in just about everything I do.
Okay.
But I think the phrase is something like those who can do and those who can't teach.
Yep.
And I'm a teacher. And so I think the implication and the question is, you know, okay, so what, you know, why aren't you building more software? And I started out building a lot of products, and there was a key realization that I had in there when I couldn't get anybody to buy them. I couldn't get anybody to pay attention to them. And short of buying advertising, which at the time I thought was way too expensive and out of my budget and all that, I just didn't know how to get customers or to get anybody to care at all. And it wasn't until I realized that if you teach people, then they're interested. And so at that point, I realized that to be good at marketing, I have to teach. It's not just a function of you know, helping people learn or something like that. It's a method of getting attention, and it's a method of getting customers.
I see.
So if I want people to buy email marketing software, right? You know, we compete with MailChimp and AWeber and companies like that. Then I've got to teach you how to do email marketing. The more I teach you that, the more you trust me. And then after a while you go, you know what? Nathan's philosophy on email marketing makes a lot of sense. Maybe I should check out his software. If I wasn't teaching, I wouldn't have any customers.
I see. So you're saying teaching online through blog posts helps you bring in an audience without paying a lot of money for it and allows you to then transfer that audience into your business and turn them into customers. I get that. But what about the books? Why the books? I mean, the reason I ask you is this. I know the objection that some people who are listening to us are going to have, which is to say, hey, this is a site where Andrew interviews successful entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. What is this guy doing being an author, marketer? Is he just selling info products online? And I thought we just handle it by acknowledging that at times you feel that way, that you're concerned about that, aren't you?
Yeah. And I definitely feel like it's kind of interesting. I feel like the training side of the business isn't as substantial in some ways, even though it makes far more revenue. And I don't know why that is. It feels a bit more temporary, even though, you know, the training side of the business makes $250,000 a year. And so I think it's just the atmosphere that we're in and kind of or the environment. Everyone wants to build software, and I'm definitely going that way too. But training and books and all of that are a fantastic way to build an audience. I wouldn't be able to build software if I didn't have a steady cash flow coming in from training products. And they're also a fantastic way to learn all these lessons about marketing and business and sales. Because if you jump in and the first product you try to sell is a SaaS app that, say, you spent $50,000 to $100,000 to develop,
yep,
and that's your first sales attempt, you're screwed. Like, there are so many lessons that you have not learned about how to sell products online that you're
for
going
example
to, let's see, what would be a good one? I mean, just getting leads in the first place, teaching or content marketing, all of that, things on conversion rates, you know, what's going to make a landing page perform well.
I see. So you need to learn all of that on smaller products before you build something that's worth $100 a month and start right there.
Well, and I think it's not the $100 a month that you're charging. It's the it's how much the software product costs to develop in the first place.
Yes.
And so if you, you know, development is expensive. And so if you can't build it yourself, you need to put out all this money, and then you're going to find that you don't have the skills necessary to sell it. And so my thinking is start with a smaller product. Start with something like an iPhone app, like an ebook, something like that. Learn all those skills. Like Jason Fried talks about how making money is a skill. Just like, I think his examples are like playing the piano and
or drumming. I remember that drumming. Post.
Yeah, yeah.
That meant a lot to me. It was an article in Inc. magazine, actually.
Yeah, that's right. And so he talks about it's something that you need to practice. And, you know, I would, in, following that example, I would see like selling a SaaS app that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to develop. I would see that as like the, you know, the huge concert in front of thousands and thousands of people. And you're not going to start your drumming career there. You got to start it with some practice and maybe like telling your buddy, hey, check this out, you know.
Gotcha. Play and, the local coffee shop before going to Madison Square Garden. All right. So let's get into how you built this, what we're, we'll compare to a local coffee shop, into a business that's actually producing hundreds of thousands of dollars where you sell these ebooks and figure out how the software part of your life fits into all this. When we go back to the thing that I said at the top of the interview, you feel like a guy who had a habit of breaking habits. When it came to writing, how did that play itself out?
Yeah, so at some point I realized that the people I admired online, the thing that was different between them and me wasn't skill level or something like that. It was the fact that they were teaching and they were writing and they were sharing, and I was keeping it all to myself. So I was like, okay, I want to start a blog. And I just, you know, I get a few blog posts out, nothing would happen. And I had this idea that I always wanted to write a book. And so I actually started three different books, and none of them made it past the outline and a handful of pages. And it wasn't until I read a blog post by Chris Guillebeau, and he said, the gist of the post was basically, it's not that hard to write a traditionally published book, a few self-published books, 100 blog posts, 50 guest blog posts. Like, he lists off all the stuff.
It's not all that the stuff hard that he has written, he said. And then he says afterwards, it's not that hard to do all this writing.
In 1 year. His thing on that. And I'm just going like, this is insane. And he says, it's not that hard if you just write 1,000 words a day. And at the time, that sounded really daunting. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking like, okay, 1,000 words, that's like 2.5 pages or so. And I had this idea for a book on designing iPhone apps, because that's what I was spending all my time doing. That was my job at the time. And I really wanted to finish this book, and I knew I had a habit of not finishing things. And so I thought, okay, I want this badly enough that I can commit to writing 1,000 words a day and actually finish the book. And so, of course, the first thing I did, like any good developer, is I built an iPhone app to help me track the habit of writing 1,000 words a day. So that was a little bit of procrastination.
It was, but, huh?
Yeah. Okay. But it paid off, you know.
It's so interesting, actually, that to you, procrastination isn't going and clicking around on Facebook or watching TV. It's writing an app.
Yeah, I definitely do the other procrastination too. Okay. I have Facebook and Twitter blocked on my computer for a good reason.
I see. If you're honest with yourself, what would you say is the reason that when you started writing, you backed away from it? What was going on in your head that made you back away from it?
I always tied everything to my current motivation and how excited I was about the idea. Okay. And so I'd think up an idea for a book or a product or anything like that, and I've started dozens of them. And you know, I'd get really excited, and I would channel all of that energy into working on the product, and then within a few days, I wouldn't have nearly the same energy, and I just wouldn't be able to sustain any kind of work on it. And so what I started doing later is tying all my effort on the product, in this case, writing a book, to a specific amount of, you know, specific outcome per day. And so that was 1,000 words a day, which for anyone who writes a lot, 1,000 words a day isn't really that much if you were a serious writer. We're talking 2 pages a day. But for me, you know, I said, I'm going to at least show up and do this much. And I figured I would chip away at it until I finished the book. And it took me a little while.
Was it the fear, if you're open with yourself, do you start to say, hey, you know what was going on in my head was I was afraid that my work wouldn't be as good as Chris Guillebeau's, or I was afraid that I don't know enough, or that I hadn't earned the right to write this book because I didn't create software like Basecamp yet, and until then I can't do it. Is it those kinds of thoughts that were going on in your head? What was going on in your head?
You know, I'm not exactly sure. I definitely had the thoughts of, am I enough of an expert to write this book?
Yep.
But I don't think that's what was keeping me from actually making any progress or sustaining motivation. I think that I was just so much in the habit of bouncing from idea to idea and relying 100% on, you know, motivation right then as my energy source for the work I was doing. Just a bad way to go. You've got to have something else driving you forward, because that motivation is going to last a week if you're lucky, you know?
That's a good point. You have to just keep going, even in those moments where it doesn't feel like an exciting thing to do, even when you don't feel like it. All right, so you created an app that allowed you to keep track of how consistent you were with your writing, and you decided that you would write 1,000 words a day. And along the way, you also decided that you would put up a landing page. At what point did you put up a landing page?
So I waited, and this is something I wouldn't recommend people do, but I waited until the book was pretty far along, mm-hmm. because I wanted to make sure that I was actually going to finish the book, mm-hmm. because I knew my own.
You had the baggage of all the past projects that you didn't finish.
Right.
Yep.
And so I started writing the book in March 2012, mm-hmm. and I put up the landing page in July 2012.
Okay.
And so during, you know, those months leading up to it, like, I'd start a habit going of writing 1,000 words a day, and I'd build up, you know, I'd track the days in a row. And if I miss a day, that count would reset. And so, you know, it'd be like I'd get 4 days and miss a day, 7 days, miss a day. And then, you know, once I got up to about 20 days or so, I didn't miss a day again. And so by the time I published the book, September 2012, I had about 75 days in a row of writing 1,000 words a day.
And how many email addresses did you have by that point?
I had 800.
800.
So, yeah.
What did your landing page say that got 800 people to give you their email address and tell you that if you wanted to sell to them, they would be open to hearing your sales pitch?
I could pull up the exact page, but it was pretty basic. It had a book graphic. And so what that does is, as soon as you show up to the page, you're like, oh, this is about a book, you know, kind of that first glance, first impression. Mm-hmm. And then it just said, talked about in a couple sentences learning to design beautiful iOS applications, and had an email opt-in form. It was really basic. I think it converted at about maybe 20-25% of visits to email addresses.
Okay.
And then, you know, it ended up on Hacker News, and then I started writing a handful of blog posts, like dissecting the new Facebook app that had just come out and trying to take design lessons away from that. And after each one of these posts, I'd say, hey, if you like this, I'm also writing a book. And I'd also send those posts to whoever was on my list at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, the first post went out to like 40 people, and then saying, hey, I wrote this post. Since you're interested in the book, you're going to like this post. Also, would you mind sharing it? And some of those people were some of the first people to like submit it to Hacker News and share it on Twitter and that sort of thing. And so it just kind of snowballed from there. The next post would go out, would be to 300 and so on.
I want to talk later on about all the different things that you sell in your package, all the things that you include in the package when you sell a book, because I think that's really clever. But the first thing that you sold was just the book written by you in, I guess it was iBook publisher format, right?
Yeah. So I wrote it in Scrivener, and then designed and published it in iBooks Author. Which is Apple's free tool, which is really
good. And that was all there was? No audio version, just the book?
So before I launched the book, I created video tutorials to go with it. Mm-hmm. And so I had code samples and that kind of thing. And I, you know, all the Photoshop files that went in the code samples, that was in that first version of the book that I launched.
I see. Okay. And so you didn't have the interviews and obviously no case studies at the time. It was that.
Actually, I did the interviews as well.
You did? Okay.
I'm trying to remember. I did not have interviews. That was something I added with the next book. And then when I relaunched the App Design Handbook, I came back and re-added it.
Okay. So you were selling more than just an iBook author design book. Mm-hmm. It was a book with video tutorials, which I'm assuming you did using ScreenFlow, right?
Yeah, I think I used QuickTime to record.
Oh, the free version. So you just were recording your computer screen and including that. See, to me, that's a very smart move. If you were just selling a book, in people's minds, you could charge them maybe $19.95 tops, $40 maybe would be too much. But if you include all these other things, you get to increase the value proposition and increase your price, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that the key thing there isn't just having one price. Because what I realized within the weeks leading up to my launch is that I had a bunch of different people on that email list of 800 people. There was a bunch of freelancers who probably had very little budget to spend. And then there were some other people, they worked for companies. They had a company credit card. And so I thought, okay, the freelancer might be able to swing $39. Like you said, that's like the top end that you would pay for a book. And that's a book that's going to help you improve your career.
Actually, I take it back. Right. The $39 is where you sell just the book. So that's pretty high.
Yeah, it is. And then I did a higher package with the videos and everything, like code samples and all that together at $129. And the thinking there was that if you want to really save time and you want to learn in this different way, then a lot of people will be willing to pay for it. And so the people buying that, my thought was people buying that would be those with company credit cards and that sort of thing. Turns out way more people buy that package than I thought. And it drove.
The package cost how much?
It was
$129
at the time.
And now, don't you have a $1,000 package that's designed to be shared with employees at a company?
Yeah. So I do packages at $39.99 and $249. And then, with one like kind of fine print package that's, if you want to share it with your whole team, buy it for $1,000.
So where do you learn to do that? To say, I'm not going, and get the nerve, frankly, even to say, I'm going to charge more and I'm going to find a way to get more.
Yeah. So the multiple packages thing, that came from Chris Guillebeau. Again, I've learned so much from that guy. It's incredible.
Really brilliant guy. Art of Nonconformity is his site. You'll have a hard time spelling Chris Guillebeau if you're searching for him, but you should be out. You should search for him. Look for Art of Nonconformity. Great book.
I learned so much from him that I actually learned how to spell his last name as well, because I felt to him. And then there were two other designers who came out with design books on the same day, actually. And this was March 2012. Their names were Sasha Grief and Jared Drysdale. And I had thought up until this point that I could write a book, but I wouldn't necessarily be able to make money from it. It would be, kind of a labor of love and might help me get consulting deals and that sort of thing. And they published their numbers, and they made like $6,500 and $8,000 in the first 48 hours each of their book.
Okay.
And I was blown away. I thought that was amazing. And so they had an interesting pricing model. Sasha was pricing his book at $3, and he had a top tier, high-priced edition at $6. And Jared had $39, just flat fee for his book. And so based on what I've been reading from Chris Guillebeau and watching that, I kind of combined their two pricing models where I took Jared's base price and was like, $39, okay, that sounds good. I read about pricing things based on value and all that. And so that was the base. And then I liked what Sasha was doing with the multiple tiers. And so I just applied that and went up from there. And it ended up being such a good decision. And since then, a lot of people selling technical books have copied that and made a lot more money because of it.
Sasha worked at HipMunk, Codecademy, I forget what else. Great guy. Interesting. Yeah. And he was still underselling his work, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, he totally was. And he's since doubled the price on that book.
Which is still very small. We're talking about $6 and $12.
Yeah, but it's also a very small book. It took him a couple weeks. Yeah, I think it took him 2 weeks to put it all together.
All right, you expected to bring in how much on the first day?
I didn't have a first day goal. After hearing their numbers, I thought, okay, if this book makes $10,000 over its entire lifetime, it'll be a success.
Okay, and how much did it make over its entire lifetime?
Now that it's had multiple editions and that sort of thing, it's at a couple hundred thousand dollars.
Wow.
But it did $12,000 in the first day, and that just blew me away.
How'd you do 12,000?
So having an email list of 800 people, if you were selling a really cheap product, that wouldn't turn into very much money. But when you're selling a product at three different price points, and you know those are higher price points, then people are going to kind of self-select into the different levels, and you're really maximizing the revenue off of a small list. And so if people are paying you $130 a piece, it doesn't take that much, you know, that many people to turn into
adding up.
Yeah. Whereas if I'd been selling it for $10, I don't think that many people more on the list would have purchased, and I would have made a lot less money.
How did you know what to include in the packages that allowed you to increase your prices?
I just thought about what would help me if I was teaching that to other people. And then I kind of had this deal going with a few guys I used to work with where they were much better programmers than I was, and I was a much better designer than they were. And so we'd help each other out on our side projects and apps. And so I knew what questions they had and that sort of thing. And so a lot of the book I wrote specifically to them, because I wanted their software to look better.
I see.
And so, I knew what they got stuck in Interface Builder and in Xcode and all these tools. And so I just tried to, I'd write a video tutorial just to help them with that. And I'd go in the top package. So,
what did you say in your email that allowed you to sell so many?
I don't think it was a copyright work of art or anything like that. I think it was, I had this interesting writing style, probably because I was so timid, that it was just kind of like, I made this thing, I hope you like it, and I would just tell people and like teach through the process of this, what now I would call a launch sequence. At the time it was just like, hey, here's a chapter I just finished, what do you guys think?
I see.
And so it came across as like probably this really, really natural style that wasn't salesy at all. Because I didn't even know how to sell, I was just like, here's this, if you like it, please buy it.
You told April in the pre-interview that one of the things you were doing on the day of the launch was refreshing your sales stats. What did you use to check those stats on?
So I was selling through Gumroad, which at the time, let's see, I think they'd been out for like 5 or 6 months at the time. But I think it was the first independent author to break $10,000 in sales on Gumroad. And now they're an amazing platform and really good friends of mine. But yeah, I was refreshing my stats on there as sales would roll in. And I was just blown away that this many people bought it. And actually, I believe the second sale to come through was for the top package, and it was from one of the designers at 30 Second Signals who bought it.
Really?
It's just like, what? And that made my day.
What do you think it was about your work that drew them to it?
I don't know.
You must have given them samples. Those people are very discerning over 37 Signals. Yes, they have a company credit card, but they have the company attitude that if stuff is junk, they have to call it out and walk away. And there's a lot of junk in the world. What was it, do you think, about what you communicated to them ahead of time that told them this is going to be a 37 Signals worthy purchase?
I think that just sharing plenty of content in advance, not holding back. One thing that people ask me a lot now is, if I put this out on my blog, isn't it that I'm giving away too much or something like that? And I just think, no, don't hold back with your audience. Give them stuff that you think is really, really valuable. You'll develop a reputation for that, and people will be happy to pay you later. I followed that philosophy for a long time.
Well, we might have just lost you there.
I bought your book and I read it and I thought, you know what? I already know this stuff. I actually got this very email today.
Yep.
Someone said, I already know all this stuff. But I realized that I already know it because I've read it all from you and in interviews and stuff like that. They still asked for a refund, which I thought was odd. But I just replied with hopefully what wasn't too snarky of an email, saying like, okay, you know, here's your refund, you know, and no hard feelings or anything. Sorry I taught you too much stuff for free, you know. But, you know, just about everyone is thrilled that you give away that much for free, and it's a great way to build an audience.
The other thing you did was watch as people favorited your tweets. What did you say on Twitter that you think spread?
You know, just linking to the articles, and I also don't think, you know, I guess it was 2 years ago. I don't think people writing technical books was quite as common, or self-publishing technical books was quite as common then as
sure
it is now.
Sure was. Don't you think? Really?
Maybe it's just that I'm in the world a lot more now, and so I see a lot more of it. But I just found that people were so thrilled to share my stuff. And just a very generous community, and you know, and it's the sort of thing where if people see that you really put a lot of effort into it and try to make it great, then they're going to, you know, be like, yeah, here's a tweet. Here, you know, a bunch of people who followed me, and actually there weren't that many people that followed me at the time.
You know what I think a large part of it is, Nathan? Tell me what you think about this. It's the design. When I look at your sales page, it doesn't feel like it's an info product. It looks like it's designed by someone with Apple's perspective on design. It looks like someone who will not allow an image to just show up on the center of a blog post. He has to have it stretch out from end to end, and then another image that just takes out the right side of it, you know? That those details matter to you. And that, I think, is what came through and got people to want to buy it, because they wanted to get that perspective for themselves, too.
Yeah, I think that's true. And especially maybe in the world of technical content and training and all of that, I think that a lot of people don't pay attention to design. And so I think you're right. That does stand out a lot, especially when you're selling a design book.
Yeah, that you had that. I don't even know if it's about what you were writing so much as just seeing the design behind everything that you did that often has impact. All right. So first day, we see your sales are doing well. It was what, $12,000 you said, right?
Yep.
Terrific. Now you've got to grow it from there. What do you do?
So I watched the sales decline over the next few days.
Makes sense.
Which was expected because all I had was email list. And so my next thought was, oh, I did it. I launched my book. And then my phone popped up with a little reminder. And it was the app I'd written, which is called Commit. And it said, are you going to write 1,000 words today? And I thought, no. I wrote my book. It's done. I've broken this reputation of not finishing things and not shipping things. And I thought, no, I'm not going to do it. And then I looked and it said, you know, 78 days in a row of writing 1,000 words a day. And I knew that if I didn't write 1,000 words today, that would reset. And so I thought, okay, I got to keep writing. And I already wrote the one book. What to write about next? Well, I spend a lot of time designing web applications. Why not write a book on that? And so I just kept writing 1,000 words a day. 90 days later, I published another book, designing web applications. Took what I learned about marketing and pricing and all of that, and I actually got some help with Patrick McKenzie for pricing on that one. He sent me an email. He was like, yeah, this is the first time I've seen a product on Hacker News recently that I didn't think, wow, this pricing is completely stupid. And so that was his lead into like helping me tweak the pricing a little more. And
what did he charge?
What's that?
What did he charge you to help you?
He didn't charge anything.
Nothing. Isn't that amazing? You're not the first interviewee that he's done that for. He just reaches out to someone out of nowhere, and then he helps them out for free, which, frankly, he should be charging. He's telling you to charge. What did he teach you about charging?
So he said he really liked the tiered pricing and that sort of thing, but he thought my prices were too low. He thought the $39 package was just fine, but that the top-end package needed to be higher priced. And so I think it went up from 129 or 150, something like that, up to 249.
And how did you come up with that? How did you know that was the right number?
I can go back to the email that he sent, but basically what he said is there's no difference in for someone with a credit card between 150 and 250. And I led a software design team at a previous company, and I'd been that person with a company credit card plenty of times before. And so it took him saying that for me to really internalize it. But I thought, yeah, he's absolutely right. And so I just bumped the price up. And so I can actually do the math on like what difference tiered pricing has had on each product launch. And on the first book, it doubled the revenue. So on the App Design Handbook, using tiered pricing doubled the revenue. And then after Patrick's little tweaks and some things I changed on the sales page, using tiered pricing tripled the revenue on the next book.
How can you tell that it's triple? Are you saying that the higher priced items brought in twice as much as the lower priced item?
So what I'm saying is, if you have a certain number of people that are going to buy the book and you only give them one option, they're all going to pay you $39
because
they decided to buy. And the person who has a $500 budget to spend on training can't give it to you, even if he loves your stuff, because you didn't give him a higher priced version with more value or anything like that. Okay. And so based on the number of sales and all that.
All right. So a second book isn't going to get you to hundreds of thousands in revenue. You had to do more to market it. What did you do that was new?
On that one, I reached out to a bunch more people. So I'd written guest blog posts, a few when the first book came out. And so I wrote a whole bunch more for this one. And I tried out interviewing other people. I think I had been too shy to reach out to people to interview them. But after seeing some success with the first book, I had some confidence. And so I added, I did all these interviews and added them in with the top packages on new book. And that did really well. Because then especially, the people that I interviewed shared the book when it came out.
You interviewed them each interview was going to be a separate product, a separate video that you were including with your package. I see. Did you pay them anything for it?
No, I didn't.
No.
And I think most of them wouldn't have done it if I'd tried to pay them.
Why do you think that?
Because, the example I like to use is there are all these developers who spend a ton of their time building open source software mm-hmm. for free. And so imagine, maybe you're using this WordPress plugin that some developer spent hundreds of hours on, and you say, hey, will you make this one tweak for me? I'll pay you $5. They're going to be pretty upset with you right then. They bill out their time at $200 an hour. They're a top-tier consultant, all this stuff. And you just offered them $10 or whatever to make this change. That's offensive. But if you ask them, hey, will you do this? You should add this to your software. They'd be like, yeah, we'll do that. So long as you don't get money involved, because this plugin or whatever is their hobby. And they're happy to help, and they want to make the internet a better place and that sort of thing. So I think once you bring money involved, if you can't pay people what they deserve, it just screws up the whole relationship.
And just accept it as a favor. If you can't pay Chris Guillebeau what he deserves to get paid for doing an interview that then becomes part of the product that you sell for one of your top tiers, might as well pay him nothing and just accept that you just did him a favor. That he just did you a favor. You owe him a favor. Or somehow the world will even itself out, instead of saying, can I pay you $100 because it's going to be an hour?
Yeah. Or like, imagine if I tried to work out a revenue share agreement with Jason Fried. I'd say this is one of many interviews in the book. So what if I pay you 2% of of gross sales? He's just gonna be like, this is stupid, and he's never gonna take the interview.
Yep. I find that people don't want to be paid. I think I wanted to make that point because I've never had anyone say, I don't think ever one say, I want to be paid for doing an interview. What I have had strangely people say is, I will pay you for this interview. And in their minds, what they're thinking is, I'm going to plug something really aggressively and Andrew's going to help me because he's going to get a share of the commissions. And so it's worth paying him money so that he plugs it really aggressively with me. And I say no to that, but right. I know others are cool with it. All right. So more blog posts, guest posting is what helped you?
And growing a bigger email list. I learned is, since I was writing on a related topic, those 800 people I had for the App Design Handbook, they didn't go away. I never had to start from scratch on this next product.
Yep.
And it's one thing, as you build an audience, you never again start from scratch. You know, even if, like, Andrew, if you were to start a new project that was maybe only had like 20 or 30% overlap with the audience for Mixergy, you don't have to start from scratch. A bunch of people are going to come over and follow you there. And so that made a big difference. So I launched the book, Designing Web Applications, to, you know, an audience that was three times as big, because I just kept following those same processes. Did some more guest posts, got the people I interviewed to help promote it, and had some improved pricing. And it ended up making $26,500 in the first 24 hours.
Really?
Yeah, so more than double what the last book had done. And then by the end of 3 weeks, just that book was at over $50,000 in sales.
Really?
Yeah.
Guest blogging, promotion from people who are in the book who say, hey, I'm in this book, and it's a great book, go get it. Wow. And your own personal list that just kept growing.
Yeah. So I should add that the guest blogging, I've since figured out how to make that effective. It was something I put a fair amount of time into for those launches, but it was not effective at all.
What did you do?
I wrote blog posts on like Web Designer Depot or Six Revisions or any of these sites, and they drove back a tiny bit of traffic, but it didn't return into sales. What worked a lot better was giving away some kind of an like writing something in the game.
Let's wait for the connection to catch up with the conversation. Let me see. I thought we lost you there for a moment. You're saying writing something and what? Tying it back to something else.
Oh, so getting people to come back to get something else from me for free and sign up for my email list. That's what worked. Sending people who'd never heard of me straight to a sales page doesn't work at all.
Give me an example. So you do a post where, and then what are you offering people who come back to your site?
So the biggest success with this that I've ever had was a post I wrote for Smashing Magazine. And it was like a 4,000 word post on product launches.
And, okay. Uh-huh.
And so it's really, really in-depth. And this was after the books and everything. This was actually
How to Profit from Selling Digital Products, part one?
No, that's another one that I've done more recently. Okay. I think this post was How to Launch Anything.
Yeah. Okay.
And so I write this really long post. And then at the end, instead of just relying on like a little link in the author bio, I actually tie in the end of the post. And some editors may not let you do this, but I did it really naturally and said, you know, you've just read all this stuff on product launches. You obviously care about it. I don't want your education to end here. So I put together a free 30-day course on mastering product launches. You know, go sign up. It's free. And I think the editors at Smashing Magazine, they wanted to take a look at the course and make sure, you know, they're like, hey, can you send us some sample from...
Make sure it's not all promotion.
Right. And... you know, they were thrilled with it, and people love that course. But that one blog post with the link through to the email course got me over 1,000 email subscribers.
Really? Wow.
Which I would since tie back to at least $50,000 in revenue.
$50,000 from this one post because you also linked it back to your site and offered people a free course. And then at the end of the free course, you said, now I don't want this to end. If you want to purchase, buy. Wow.
Yeah, what I found is when you have a handful of products at the right price points and that kind of thing, an email address is worth really a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and we're talking not with the first sale, but the people who buy multiple products and really be part of your ecosystem. So, yeah, it ends up being worth a lot. That's why I put so much energy and attention into growing an email list.
What about the fact that the course gives away so much for free, and why would anyone want to sign up if you've given away all your best stuff?
Books are long enough that even if you give away a ton of stuff for free, there's still lots more great stuff in there. And a lot of people, you know, if they learn so much from you, they want to support you. I think it's just generally the approach is giveaways and demonstrate so much value that it makes the purchase really easy. And if some people feel like, you know, the 70% of new content in the book isn't enough, they'll ask for a refund. And you know, you'll always get some people asking for refunds. That's fine. Don't get upset over it. Just issue the refund and move on. But yeah, I'd say if you get people to trust you and if you help them, they'll be happy to pay for it.
Do you use any affiliates?
I have done a few random little affiliate things. Like, I consider like AppSumo an affiliate type thing. We've done that 3 or 4 times. But otherwise, like, I didn't have any affiliates at launch. And a few people have been like, you know, you're missing out on so much revenue and all this stuff. And I don't know. I'll figure out affiliates someday. It's on the list.
What are you doing with, is it Tapiti?
Tapiti, yeah.
Tapiti.
So that was this last year. It came time to update. You know, iOS 7 came out. My book was quickly going to become out of date. Mm-hmm. I'd moved on to lots of other things where, you know, I had an email marketing company that was growing. I'd written a couple more books. And the AppSumo Handbook was my worst selling book at the time. It was still doing just fine. It was doing maybe $3,000 or $4,000 a month without much promotion. It came time to update the book, and I didn't want to write more about app design at the time. It wasn't an interesting topic to me because I was so focused on all things marketing, and you know, that's what I really cared about. And so a couple of friends in my mastermind group basically cut through my whining about this and said, okay, you have a couple options. You either suck it up and update, you know, rewrite the book for iOS 7, which is a huge rewrite. You find a co-author, and they gave me, you know, a date to find a co-author by. It was like 7 days later. And they said, or you take the book down from sale. And, you know, I wouldn't have missed that couple thousand dollars a month in revenue very much. And so they laid out those choices clearly of, you know, focusing on these other things or what to do. And I decided to find a co-author. And I ended up coming across Jeremy Olson, who... he had read my other book, Authority. He was interested in building an audience around app design. He's a fantastic designer, had won an Apple Design Award. He's actually better qualified to write a book than I am. And so we ended up partnering up, and we split the revenues for the new edition. He rewrote
the book, and you marketed the book.
Yeah. Yep. And it took... So now I'd say the content is about half mine, half his.
I see. And Tapiti is his personal blog.
Tapiti is his consulting company.
Consulting company.
So if you need fantastic designers to build you an iPhone or iPad application, they do amazing work. So yeah, he wanted to break into the training and publishing space, and it worked out really well. Random fact about Jeremy is he and I are born on the exact same day.
Really?
Like not... I'm not talking like we have the same date, but I mean like...
You're the same age, exactly.
Exact same age. I'm not sure who's older, but whichever one of us is older, it's by a couple of hours. Anyway, random thing about Jeremy. He's been fantastic.
I didn't realize that was a site. I saw him on the cover of the book on one of the pages here, one of the open tabs, but I didn't realize that was his site. By the way, as a designer, now I'm clicking around your site. I love your design. What do you think of this? Does this look right on camera to you that I have this big cage around my mic? Because I don't think I really need a shock mount. It's not like there's so much shocking movement in here.
I think it's just fine. I don't think it intrudes any more than the microphone already does. So.
I want it to intrude just a little bit to send the signal to the guest, hey, this is a real professional interview, but not so much that it distracts.
Right.
And you think that we're doing okay there?
Yeah. If I had my recording set up, then I'd have a shock mount coming into the screen as well. But right now I just have a little microphone.
Really? That's the blue snowball that we're hearing? Usually that mic is just a little too quiet.
Yeah. I don't know. That's what you're hearing.
Yeah, so, it does sound like a really, really good mic there. Let me see what else we want to talk about. Oh, I should say this. To anyone who's listening who wants to follow up and says, hey, you know what? All this... guest post sounds interesting. All this marketing automation sounds interesting. I've got a couple of courses that I'd like for you to check out. The first is with John Morrow. I know the course is about growing an email list, but John is fantastic at doing guest posts and converting those guest posts into members of his mailing list and then selling products without being a pushy salesman. Well, he did a course on Mixergy that I urge you to take. It's called Grow Your Email List. He's fantastic. He's clearly an experienced speaker who knows how to tell stories, who backs every step that he gives you, the audience, with a specific thing that you can do and with examples of how he did it. So he's not just pontificating. He's showing you, this is what I did. Here's a screenshot of how I did it. Here's how you can do it yourself. Great, great course. And then there's also another one that I wanted to recommend, and I just now forgot it because I was so busy gushing about John Morrow. So I'll tell you what, instead of forcing a second one or forcing myself to try to remember it, I'm just going to tell you, John Morrow is that good. I could forget all my other guests when I just look at his work. It's really good, and I urge you guys to take it.
Nice. I'd say that guest posts, if you do them correctly, are one of the best ways to grow your email list.
So what else can we do correctly? He also says don't just leave it as a guest post with the standard bio, the standard link from the bio to your site. He says make sure that you give people an incentive to come back to your site. Otherwise, they're not going to do it. You said it. What else?
I like to tell stories in my posts because one thinking is that so the people who don't come back to get that incentive and come on my email list, I want them to at least remember me. And so instead of just being like, you know, very robotic, here's how to design a website or, you know, whatever the post is about. I like to tell personal stories that tie into the post. It makes the writing a lot more interesting, but it also means that they're going to remember, oh yeah, there's that Nathan guy. You know, I don't want them to ever get to the end of a post and not know who it was written by
And associate the great quality writing with Smashing Magazine as opposed to with you. You want them to know it's you.
I want to have a distinct style. I want to be recognized I don't want them to think this is just another post on whatever.
So how do you tell a story?
I don't know, that's something I'm constantly learning, but usually it's as I'm writing something, whatever pops into my head of some anecdote. I have a lot of stories of, you know, failed design projects and that kind of thing from my startup days when I, you know, worked on a design team. And so, yeah, I just try to launch into one of those. And
here's what I learned. Maybe this will help you realize some of the things that make you a good writer. One of the things that I was told, one of the things that I try to do is if there's a point I want to make, I think back to my life where I experienced either doing it well or failing at it. And then one of the big lessons that I learned from Dale Carnegie was we always used to teach students there to jump right into the action of the story, no backstory. So if I want to tell you about the time that I bought my dog a muzzle, I start out by saying, I bought my dog a muzzle. And as I logged on to Amazon, I thought to myself, this muzzle better really protect him because, you know, and then I give the backstory that way. But you start with the action and you try to keep it active as much as possible.
That's good.
What else? What do you got?
Now I got to follow up that. I think being vulnerable in stories,
yes,
it's really easy, and especially after I had a handful of successes to tell people about, it was really easy for me to tell stories that just made me look good. But I found the ones that resonated with people were when I told stories of failures, or maybe it was eventually a success, but it didn't make me look amazing all the way through the story. And so I think vulnerability is really, really important to get people to connect with you.
All right, speaking of vulnerability, you broke the streak, the one you're so proud of, the one that finally got you writing a book, the one that you kept track of using your own app, the one that you talked about on your site. You broke it. How did you break it and what happened?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, I was amazingly proud of this streak. It became a huge part of my online identity that I had written 1,000 words a day for, you know, 500, 600 days in a row. And I don't actually even know how long the streak was when I broke it. It was somewhere in like the 675 range, something like that.
So a little over 2 years, or roughly 2 years.
Roughly 2 years, not quite. You know, life at some point just kind of fell apart. Like, I think it started with my second son was born, and that was challenging. And I went through a couple-week period where basically both my kids stopped sleeping. And, you know, I had a two-year-old and a two-week-old at the time. And so, you know, that went poorly. And then I ended up just with all these health issues. What it came down with is I got shingles, which was, I've later found out, was stress-induced. It's amazing how much stuff, how much bad things will happen to you because of stress. And so, you know, everything...
All right, so instead of going into all the things that broke apart because of the stress, I got to push you and ask you then, what happened that was so stressful? It looked like you were doing well at the time. You were on a streak. You were making money. You were doing what you loved. But underneath, there was a lot of stress. What was the stress from?
So the stress was all from things outside the business. So it was that we just bought a house and was remodeling it. It was a brand new kid, all that kind of thing. And then it just all built on itself. And so then... after breaking that streak and realizing it, it was actually like a couple months that were, I just couldn't find motivation. And because my first thought was, once I realized I broke the streak, I was like, oh, I'll get it right back. And it, that was over 2 months ago. And my current streak of writing 1,000 words a day is at 8 days in a row.
Wow.
So it took me a long time to get it back. And, you know, it's just, for the last 3 months or so, it's been a constant struggle of motivation, depression.
Depression?
Focus. Yeah.
What's that about?
So I think I tie a lot of my personal identity and self-worth in what I accomplish. And the more I've accomplished, you know, writing 3 books in a year, that kind of thing, the easier it is to do that. And so then when I went through a couple months of getting very, very little done, I started to fall into that rut and then feeling less and less motivated. And it was actually a comment on Reddit, of all places, that really got me thinking. And it was just a one-line comment, and somebody said, depression doesn't feel like sadness. It feels like apathy, that you just don't care anymore. Mm-hmm. And that got me thinking, like, oh, maybe I'm actually depressed. And so then it's been, I think I read that probably a month and a half ago. And so it's just been kind of a journey of dealing with all the, getting rid of all the stressful things, getting health back in line, and trying to feel successful again. So I started picking one thing each day that when I accomplished that, the day was a success.
Have you considered suicide at all, honestly?
Not recently.
No, it's when did you?
That was something back in, you know, back in high school. I think that that's fairly common. But yeah, not recently.
It's not part of this depression cycle. This depression cycle is just plain apathy. It's not.
Yeah.
You said earlier that you feel like a fraud in everything you do. I wrote that down. In everything I do, I have imposter syndrome. Why?
I think there's always someone more qualified to do it. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of designers who are way better than I am. There are plenty of business people who would grow a startup and a company way more effectively than I would. You know, every time I do a product launch, even though I have this past success, I this one might be the one that flops. But you know what? Even the people I talk to who are running businesses way, way bigger than mine, a lot of them feel it too. And so it's something that I've come to accept, that I'm always going to feel not qualified and not ready to do what I'm about to do. And I'm trying to remember who told me this. But basically, I wish I could give credit, but oh well. If you do feel ready and fully prepared for what you're about to do, then you're probably not shooting high enough. You're working fully within your comfort zone, and you're not going to improve and make progress.
Let me understand what it's like for you when you feel like a fraud. For me, it's things like, if I'm about to create a page explaining something that I'm going to launch, it's a vision of maybe Chris Guillebeau and how pretty his pages are. Today it might be yours. You know, now that I've studied yours so carefully in preparation for this interview, in my mind, it wouldn't be, I feel like an imposter. It would be more like, how could you allow this page to go out when Nathan respects you and Nathan created all these beautiful pages and he cares about the background to such a degree that there's even a grid on the back of one of his on like the background of one of his pages, so it looks like graph paper. He's paying attention to things that you don't even know how to identify. What is it like for you?
For me, it's more looking at people above me rather than, I guess, the people in my audience. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a person who comes to mind sometimes?
It depends on the category, but Chris Guillebeau on all writing things, Rob Walling on all things software.
Rob Walling on anything software. So when you were creating ConvertKit, did you think of Rob Walling and say he would do this so much better?
Yeah, to some extent. And then now there's a lot of other people, like I have Amy Hoy in my head every time I'm writing a sales page or something like that. And, you know, I have this tendency to want to jump in and design a sales page before writing it. And, you know, then I think, oh, Amy would be telling me, no, you've got to write all the copy and pay attention to the written word before you jump into design.
Interesting.
So, you know, I have all these little...
Those are helpful, though. Is there a voice that's not helpful?
I don't know.
Okay.
I think the voice for me that's not helpful is the, you're not qualified enough to do this.
It's who just that phrase. You're not qualified enough to do this.
Who are you to write a book on designing iPhone apps? You didn't design the Facebook app or Foursquare or something like that.
So did it hurt when I started this interview with that comment?
No, because you warned me that it was coming.
If I didn't warn you it was coming, how would it feel?
I would have been taken off guard a little bit.
Yeah.
But I think it's something that that I deal with and think about enough that, you know, it's an easy thing now to answer.
Okay. All right, I want to end it with this. I tried to see what ConvertKit's landing pages look like. Mm-hmm. I don't see anything about it on the site. Your designs are so beautiful. I just wanted to go see what is the design going to be that you would create for me if I were to use ConvertKit to create landing pages for myself. And all I see is the course. Is that intentional?
It's just a fact that the landing page functionality came out 3 weeks ago. And so for a long time, ConvertKit was just courses or, you know, creating drip courses. And
it was email software that allowed you to create drip courses.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so what we realized is we need to make it as easy as possible for people to capture as many leads. Mm. And so we need to have landing pages as well to do that. And so that was the reason for adding that functionality. And it just hasn't made it on a refresh of the marketing site yet.
Okay. I do like, and we talked about this before we started, I really like the way your software lets publishers organize the email that they want to drip out. It looks like, I don't know how to describe it. It's just logical. You can easily see this is the first email, and if you click it, here's what goes in it. And you can see on the left all the other emails in a row, and you can sort them by just dragging and dropping where you want them to go. Drip email is so powerful, but for some reason, it's incredibly complicated on other software packages. And on some, like Aweber, it feels like an afterthought.
Well, and on MailChimp as well. So I came into this from MailChimp where I got into email marketing, and first, I'll be the first to say that I was amazingly late to the game, where, like, I told one of my internet marketing friends, like, did you know how all email marketing converts? And he's like, yeah, I've known that for a decade. You know, so I was very late to the party there, but I learned all these techniques that worked really well, like autoresponders, you know, or drip email. And then when I go to set it up in, like, MailChimp or another program, it was such a pain that I just wouldn't do it, even though I knew it would make my business more money, because I was so frustrated with it. And then my thought was, if other people are just as frustrated as I am, then I should solve that problem. And that's what got me into software, you know, back into software.
Who coded it for you?
So I've had a handful of different developers working on it. But the current guy is a guy named Mark, who's been in my audience for quite a while. I will say that if you have to hire developers, having a popular blog read by software developers is like the ultimate hack for hiring people. It makes it so easy. You just say, hey, I'm looking for a developer. And then you get like 20 people who say, oh, pick me, who already know what it is that you're working on and that kind of thing. I would say having an audience is the hack for all things online business.
It really is. For all things online in general, for just making it in a brand new country. If you just happen to be in town, you want to know what's available. Boom, you go to your audience. You say, I'm here in this new country. And they know you. They know what you're about. They're going to recommend good things. I remember being in Patagonia. And the founder of a vineyard, of a winery there, emailed me, Michael, why am I not thinking? The Vines of Mendoza. He emailed me, just happened to hear that I was in town, and I got to go and have an asado, a barbecue, at his place. It was beautiful. Wow. You don't get that kind of experience if you just walk into town and you try to figure things out for yourself. Yelp isn't going to do it for you.
Right.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, I've been taken out to lunch in Costa Rica before because somebody saw, I posted on Twitter that that's where I was, and they're like, hey, love to meet up. And so much good stuff that comes from an audience.
I should say this, that by the time this is up, if anyone wants to, they can learn a little bit about how to do interviews the way that I do by just going to interviewyourheroes.com. I really urge you to do those interviews because they're a good way of getting to know your heroes and then publish them online so that you build that audience for yourself. And when you are in Mendoza, maybe the founder of the Vines of Mendoza will reach out to you too. interviewyourheroes.com. All right, and Nathan, if people want to follow you, I told you before we started there are too many places that I could suggest that they go to. How about we pick one and say this is the place where you can go if you want to connect with Nathan or see a sample of your work?
Yeah, so I'd go back to that. We talked about it earlier, but the email course that I put out for the Smashing Magazine readers, it's nathanberry.com/launch. And if you sign up there, you can reply to the first email that comes out and that'll come straight to me. You'll have my contact info. But then also, if you're into marketing and launching books and all of that, I think you'll really love that content. And it's totally free.
Cool. And the form there, is that, and the whole landing page, is that created by ConvertKit the way I see on the bottom?
Yeah, it is.
So we can see a sample of what your landing pages look like there. All right. Yeah. Thank you so much for doing this. Thank you all for being a part of it. Bye, guys.